I'm very pleased to welcome a new contributor to our series on books and audiobooks. Terry Prince is involved in the Abbey Theatre. He's been working there for some years, I believe, as a director as well as an actor. And he's also a reader on the Talking Newspaper. Terry, welcome, and thank you very much for coming in to discuss a book that you read by accident, by design. How do you come across something like The Reader on the 627?
Well, actually, it was brought for me by my wife, who is French, and it's a novel, French in origin. What we're dealing with this afternoon is a translation. I hope listeners won't be put off by that, because it's a very, very good translation. She bought it for me because she was absolutely thrilled with it when she read it, and so were many of her French friends, and wanted to introduce me to it. So that's how I came to it, and I'm very fortunate that I did.
Even though it's a translation, it has a very French style, not just because it's set in France, but because the way in which it's written is really quite charming. And if anybody's seen the film Amélie or read the book, it's got nothing to do with that, but it has a sort of same sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so. It's absolutely delightful. It's quirky. It's unusual. It's full of characters who live kind of off the edge of normal, whatever normal might mean, kind of normal existence, you know. Slightly lovable in many ways. And people who have, in one way or another, been damaged, possibly, in their life. In one case, physically, severely. And in other cases, by choices they have made or been made on their behalf. But there's a kind of resilience that shines through them. And anybody who enjoys books, and in this case enjoys being read too, should find this a very, very delightful and charming read indeed.
It has certain oddities which we will come to, which we will discover. But the title, The Reader on the 627, has to be explained. Unfortunately, it's explained fairly quickly, but do you want to give us a slight run-in?
Well,
to...
it's what it says on the box, actually, Rob, really, isn't it? It's, without giving too much away, a guy who reads to the other occupants of the carriage in which he takes his daily commute to work, and he reads pages from books.
As the compartment began to sway, he took the cardboard folder out of the leather briefcase that never left his side. He opened it cautiously and exhumed a piece of paper from between two sheets of candy pink blotting paper. The flimsy, half-torn page with a tattered top left-hand corner dangled from his fingers. It was a page from a standard 6x9-inch format book. Gilan examined it for a moment, then placed it carefully back on the blotting paper. The carriage gradually fell silent. Sometimes there was a reproving shh to silence the few conversations that had not petered out. Then, as he did every morning, Gilan cleared his throat and began reading aloud.
Can't read the entire book because the book no longer exists. And the irony is that although he loves literature, he loves books, his job is to work in a pulping machine which destroys books. But he manages to rescue the odd page here and there, and these he shares with his fellow travellers. Can you imagine people on the commute from St Albans to London suddenly reading anything to anybody, let alone pages rescued from books? His fellow passengers become enthralled by his readings, and when you listen to the book, as I hope you will understand why this happens. Would that it happened in real life? Wouldn't that be nice?
So they wait for him eagerly, and he's always got something which he's found the previous day at his work. And you've described that as being a pulping machine. It's quite a nasty-sounding thing. Books that are either finished with or haven't sold, they're shoved into this machine. I mean, he uses a pickup truck sort of thing to throw them in, and they get mashed up by this ferocious machine. He calls it
the thing. It has a technical name, the Zestraw or something like that, but to me, and anybody who reads it, I'm sure, the thing sums it up perfectly.
As always, walking towards the works, he heard old Giuseppe's grating voice in his head. "You're not cut out for this, kiddo. You don't know it yet, but you're not cut out for it." The old boy knew what he was talking about. He had never found anything better than red plonk to give him the strength to go on. Gilan hadn't taken any notice, naively believing that in time he would get used to it, that the routine would intrude into his life like an autumn fog and numb his mind. But even after all these years, at the sight of the high, grubby, peeling perimeter wall, his throat was always assailed by nausea. On the other side crouched the thing, well hidden from view. The thing was waiting for him.
And it's not only ferocious in the sense that it destroys the books, but it has the potential to do damage to anybody who gets near it, or, as his predecessor did,
absolutely,
gets into it.
Giuseppe has fallen victim, in, as you say, a physical way, to the thing. Giuseppe is just one of many of these kind of slightly eccentric, off-the-wall characters we meet, and his story is an absolute delight.
It had taken Giuseppe nearly 3 months to come round to the fact that his legs were not going to grow back. 3 months to accept those hideous pink stumps once and for all, two swollen lumps of flesh reminiscent of the gnarled branches of an ancient lime tree.
His accident happened on a certain day, and he then sets out to work out what happened to all the, well, his legs, among them.
Well, exactly. Let's say there's a very close connection between the real job of the pulping machine to pulp books and the accidental job of the pulping machine, which was to pulp Giuseppe's legs. And there's a connection between those two and sets him off on a journey, since he can't recover his legs, to recover the book that was pulped with his legs.
Guillain's dismay made Giuseppe wriggle with delight in his wheelchair. Only then did the words read out by the old boy sink in. The 16th of April, the very day that his legs had been gobbled up by the Zerstor. Flesh and bone crushed, pounded, boiled and dispersed into millions of cells that had ended up inextricably mingled with the grey magma shat into the vats by the thing on that cursed day in April 2002. The start of a long journey to end up in this inconsequential book and in the 1,299 others made with this unique paper pulp. Guillain stood there dumbfounded. The old fellow had found his legs.
The hero of the story, his name is Vilain Guignol, which he hated his parents for giving him, because if you happen to know French, you can play around with that name and it becomes something completely different. He actually visits Giuseppe frequently.
That's correct.
And he starts out to help him in his own quest.
That's correct.
So that's how those two tie together.
That's correct.
A lot of the early part of the book is really about those two, isn't it? Other characters come in, but it's about him and his relationship to the thing and the machine, the dreadful boss he's got who bullies him from his gantry up in the factory.
Yeah.
And he hates the job. And he's told his mother that he's got a slightly different job, hasn't he?
He's told his mother that he's much more important in the world of books and publishing than in fact he is.
His mother never answered before the third ring. Three rings, the time it took to rouse herself from her absence. "Hello, Mum." "Oh, it's you." He smiled. Every week she came out with the same reply as a prelude to the great game of questions and answers. "What's the weather like in Paris? Had the latest transport strike caused him problems?" Questions which he answered in the same evasive manner, already fearing the moment when he was going to have to lie to his own mother. The dreaded subject came up as always. "Still working in books?" His mother knew nothing. Nothing of the pulping plant, nor of his job of evil murderer. Years of deception, keeping quiet about the horror and inventing a better job, building an artificial life just for her. The life of a Guillain who ate and drank things other than tasteless cereals and insipid tea. A Guillain who did not spend his days reducing tons of books to mush. This Guillain Vignol did not share his life with a goldfish.
It's rather sad, really, that he's not sufficiently confident to reveal what he does and even to mention the great joy that he brings to so many people, not only on the train, But as a result of his reading on the train, he gets invited to take his reading elsewhere, to a room full of rather elderly ladies and gentlemen who embrace his readings. He's not a confident person at all. He's a very lonely person, very sad in many ways. But he does find, through a happy accident, he does come across a manuscript.
We can say, well, how this happened. I mean, basically, he gets on the train every day with his own material he's going to read.
Correct.
And he comes across a memory stick.
And
on that memory stick is somebody else's writing that he's able to get all of.
Yeah.
And then he starts to read that to his regular daily audience, but also, as you say, into this residential home or whatever else.
Right.
And that leads him down a new avenue. So we've got this lonely character who, by accident, encounters through the reading somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this is obviously a woman, and she had defined her job in the text. It's quite an odd job. Again?
Yes. This is Julie. Julie is a lavatory attendant, but she's a very unusual lavatory attendant. She doesn't fit the stereotype of what a lavatory attendant is or what a lavatory attendant does. She's a girl of great imagination and a wordsmith, and she keeps a diary.
When you're a public lavatory attendant, wherever that may be, you're not expected to keep a diary and sit there tapping away on the keyboard of your laptop. You're only good for wiping from morning to evening, shining the chrome, scrubbing, polishing, rinsing, refurbishing the cubicles with toilet paper, and that's it. A loo attendant is meant to clean, not to write. It's okay for me to do crosswords and word searches, find the hidden word, look for words locked up in all sorts of grids. It's also okay for me to read photo stories and women's magazines or TV guides during my spare time. But for me to tap away with my fingers chapped by bleach on a laptop setting out my thoughts, that is beyond comprehension. Worse, it arouses suspicion. It's as if there has been a misunderstanding, a miscasting. In the netherworld, even a miserable 12-inch laptop next to the tips saucer will always be a blot on the landscape.
But as she says, it wouldn't be appropriate to be seen keeping a diary. So she, a bit like Ghislaine, has to hide a part of her real character and subsume it under people's expectations. It's to a large extent not taking people on appearances. And behind that is this very skilled diarist who writes about her job. And some of the most amusing passages in the book are her encounters with her clients, Rob, or her customers, you know, which are a joy to read. She's a very sparky girl.
I said, who clearly could have gone somewhere other than
absolutely.
I mean, even though her aunt had preceded her in that job,
she inherited the job. Yeah, the family is nepotism. Rob there, lavatory attendant. It's a USB stick that he listens to and becomes enthralled by Julie, and actually finds himself wanting to track her down. Now, there are many public lavatories in Paris, and they run into thousands. He's determined to find her, and he enlists the aid of Giuseppe.
That evening, Ghislaine went over to Giuseppe's. Sometimes he needed more than a goldfish to share his feelings. For nearly half an hour, he talked about the USB stick, explained how he had devoured the 72 documents it contained. He told Giuseppe excitedly about Julie, how the young woman wrote about her day-to-day life in little notebooks surrounded by 14,717 white tiles. The old man listened attentively and took in every word of what his friend was telling him. "How can I find her? I don't know anything about her," lamented Ghislaine. Giuseppe smiled. "You know a lot more about her than you think. Don't be so defeatist," Giuseppe reassured him. "Do you think my legs grew back in a day?" he said, pointing to the shells bowing under the weight of the fraisinet. "Have you got the stick with you? Download those files for me, and I'll have a good look at them. There can't be that many toilets in shopping centres that have attendants." When Ghislaine left, Giuseppe pumped his hand profusely. I've got a feeling in my bones that you too will succeed in your quest, murmured the old man with a smile.
And so he determines to set out on this quest to find Julie, to track her down with the help of Giuseppe. But there are, of course, thousands of public lavatories throughout Paris, though there's never one available when you want one, from my experience. And Giuseppe shows great skill and qualities of research in helping Ghislaine in his quest to bring these two together. And, of course, he's never seen Julie before, so what's he going to be faced with? So there's an anxiety as well as a desire to see the quest through and meet up with her. Will she like him? Will he like her? He's certainly seduced by her writing. And that's a lovely thing. Again, it's about, as this book is so much about, the power of language and the love of language and the joy of language. So he sets off on the quest for Julie.
And as you
I'm not going to tell you what happens.
Of course not. As you said earlier, all the characters are outsiders in some sense, or on the edges of normal society, if you like, and they're doing very strange jobs. And yet they seem both to be very good at communicating. Well, in different ways. One communicates through reading, the other communicates through writing. So we're playing games here with the novelist is playing games.
Yeah.
I don't know anything else by this particular author, Jean-Paul Didier.
Neither do I. It was, as I say, completely new to me. My wife bought it for me and said, you're going to love this. And she was absolutely right. I believe he has just brought out another one recently. And I will certainly make it my job to find out if it's been translated yet and track it down. I hope I've brought across my enthusiasm and love for the book because it was out of the ordinary. You use the word outsider. These people are outsiders, but they're outsiders in the nicest possible way. They're not outsiders who are violent or destructive or anything like that. I think it's rather nice to come across characters in literature who are like these people. Very humble in their own way, aren't they? And, very down to earth. And they don't expect a lot from life, but very generous in their nature as well, I found. Very generous. So I kind of like that. You mentioned Amélie earlier. I think this also has something of the quality of a fable about it. And that also attracted me to it.
Thank you, Terry. That's The Reader on the 627 by Jean-Paul Didier Laurent. And it was translated by Roz Schwartz. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.